Deda shi ge dambe chunyin chen nen de shi shi namo la ye ge dan lu dan nu jen ge du gong da dan mi ye ge nam dan du wa kun ge cha nam chi zam tam je ge du da ge chue dun to se. Good morning. Did you have difficulty getting parking? This is one of the perks, isn't it? Living in Minnesota. Okay, let's begin the usual thing. First, we begin with the sharing session. So anybody want to share anything that you are able to apply in your life, anything that you learned, please feel free to share so that we all can benefit.
Well, this is not new for me, but I have this reminder of impermanence, which is my aging father,
mm-hmm.
now 97 years old and fading, and once a very bright, capable engineer, a very insightful person, and now he's hard of hearing, he falls asleep, he's forgetful. Telephone conversations with him are almost impossible. This is, you know, still my father, but he is changed. He's grown old. And where once he raised me and took care of me, now his children, we have to look after him. And every once in a while, he's far away, so I can't see him very often, but I make trips to go visit him, just mm-hmm. to make sure everything is okay and he has caretakers to take care of. But daily, always, I'm reminded of impermanence and, well, also his all that he gave to me, and thankful to be able to provide something for him in return.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, impermanence. So we all know that in Buddhism, impermanence is so much emphasized, and that one of the reasons is that, you know, when you are able to have this insight into impermanence, then that kind of motivates you to use your life in a meaningful way, not just for this world, just for temporary, to fulfill temporary goals, but you will try to do something more than that, beyond, you know, fulfilling our needs to survive. So this, yeah, is very good. So sometimes, yeah, these come as a reminder, very strong reminder. Then, yeah, you feel, oh, I must do something. And of course, this is inevitable. Everybody will go through this process. Nobody can escape aging. We all must. How healthy and, you know, how good look you have, all this. We have to go through this. So there's no escape. And then, as you mentioned, once you are at that stage, first of all, your mind is not really alert, so you don't even remember to do practice. And then even if you want to, your body, even your mind want to do something, but your body is unable to follow your wish. So this then teaches us that while we have the ability, while we are healthy, while we have this capability, we must do we must do, you know, we must prepare so that we don't have any regrets when this aging, that real, I mean, that stage comes. Thank you. Anyone?
I want to share something.
Please.
The last week we study about the generating
compassion. Bodhicitta.
What instant happened that whole week was Monday during my lunch period. I walk about 6 blocks to send the money to Union. And I send the money. The next day, the person who was going to receive that said that my name was incorrect, or I don't use the first name, the first only the one name. So next Tuesday, during my lunch time again, I walk to change the name, and then I went to one bank, to another bank, one agency, to another agency, walking in the cold skyway, I get lost. So, and Wednesday, again, I went there, and I sent the money to say, okay, we need two names. The person has only one name, so the system doesn't take it. So again, I went back and asked them on Thursday, again, they need two names, and then finally I arranged to send it through someone who has two names. So whole week I was walking during my lunchtime, 6 blocks. One day in the outside, the cold. So then on Thursday I was like, I'm not going to send any money next time. Immediately I applied that mindfulness. I said, we were learning and applying this bodhicitta. If you generate want to be a bodhisattva, you have to even forgive or give away your hands, even your body and every blockings. I am walking only 2-6 blocks, and now I get agitated. So shame on me. So that was kind of, it reminded me the whole thing that we learned.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's
come down when I immediately think about that. Shame on me. It's nothing. Walking 6 blocks is nothing in comparison to giving away your hands and limbs and all your belongings for other people in order to be a bodhisattva. So that was kind of very.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, that's what I want to see. You see, we learn here. And then, yeah, we apply. Otherwise, I mentioned earlier, otherwise it's just another intellectual collection. You make notes, you know, all this, and then pile it back there. That's it. Another teacher comes. You do the same thing, repeat. There is no change. But whatever we learn here doesn't have to, you know. Actually, it's better to apply than you know everything. You know, whatever you know, whatever little you can apply, if you are able to go out in the real world, you know, while we are sitting here, we are all, you know, all bodhisattvas. When we go out and if you are able to apply this, even just a small portion of it, that is a progress. That is worth coming to class. That is worth braving the cold. Otherwise, same thing. You have all that knowledge. And I have nothing new to tell you. You have whatever I'm actually saying is what, there's nothing that you haven't heard before. So here, from the beginning, I mentioned that we will try to make this something different. It's not different that, you know, I can tell you something different, that I teach something unique. There is nothing unique. Whatever I'm saying here, sharing with you, that whatever I'm sharing is that same thing that you have heard from many great lamas, great teachers. But only thing I am requesting you to is, you know, just don't leave there. Try to apply. Of course, you cannot apply everything you learn, but at least if you are mindful, if you make the determination that, you know, I will this time, I will do something different, I will try to apply as much as I can. then yeah, it becomes different. Otherwise, same old thing. after I leave this place, another teacher will come. Same thing. You will come to class, and same thing. Repeat. After you go back, and at the end of the year, what did I learn? Yeah, I learned all this. How have I changed? Was there any transformation? No, I am the same angry person, same grumpy old man, whatever it is. So no point. So this is good, yeah, apply, you know. So I told you about, I let you into my secret about being mindful. It is not easy. Most of the time I don't remember. But in the evening, when during night time, and I went, oh, today I wasn't that good. I wasn't able to be mindful all the time. But you see, as long as you have this one, it keeps you going. And then you hope for the next day to be a better one. So that's how we progress. And just I remembered something about Tibetans. This habit. We have this name. We don't have surname. So when we apply for visas at American Embassy, they will give you name. They will give you FNU, that's first name unknown. And then sometimes they will give you LNU, last name unknown. You have no choice but to have that. So surname will show as LNU. Actually, it means last name unknown, but the officers don't know what that stands for. So my friend Lama went to one of those government office, and he was waiting in the queue. I don't know what he went for. And he was waiting for his name to be called. And then he said, Mr. Lanu? So he was like, he didn't know that's me. Mr. Lanu? And then said, Mr. Lanu Galarumpache? Oh, then he realized that, oh, he's calling for me. It's a call for me. That's just something that I remembered. So, Americans, you see, you're so fortunate. You can, first of all, you can travel almost everywhere. You don't even have to apply visa at the arrival. But for us, first of all, many wouldn't accept our travel document. There were times the early days when I started travel. And even that Indian immigration wouldn't even recognize this. And they would say, what is this? Because they issue a travel document which is really thick, but only few pages. Just the cover is so thick, but only few pages in there. And they will look at it, run it over, and then they will ask somebody else. And then when you go to apply for visas, I don't know why I'm saying all this. Okay, I think let's not go into that. Anyway, yeah, this is true, you know. It's a reminder that how fortunate we are, you know. So this is good. Sometimes, yeah, we take everything for granted. We don't realize that how difficult, you know, it is for other people. You don't know. And then something small thing happens. Oh, you know, I elected him for this and this. Ah, you do this, you do this. There's so much complaint. Yeah, when you appreciate what you have, then, yeah, you will be less bitter. You will be less grumpy. That helps. If you're less grumpy, of course, you will be happier. Your life will be happier, isn't it? Okay, anybody wants to share anything?
I listened to a story this morning. It was good. It was a doctor who was he was over at a with a group of other workers helping some third world people, and he decided to go and help these two families. Then it was a seven hour walk,
mm-hmm.
And his colleagues were criticizing him. Why would you leave all these people that need help here just to go over and help these two people over here? And he said that was what was wrong with the entire world, because nobody is less or more than anybody else. And I thought that was a really, really a very good, compassionate story. And the other thing he said was quite interesting, and he said that the activity of compassion is actually emptiness, and that the actual, when you're responsive or when you're trying to, whatever your style or whatever your way is, you're trying to respond to something or to have compassion for something, but yet, in some ways, silence and having no response is also a response.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now let's try to dive into today's topic. So last week we talked about the methods, the two methods, how to cultivate, how to develop compassion. So we have now one method that involves these six causes, and then another method, exchanging oneself and others. So these are the two different methods, but they, two of these converge at developing or cultivating the sense of endearment. In Tibetan we call it yiwong. So once you have the sense of endearment, or sometimes it's translated as affectionate love, then we will be able to generate compassion. And then with compassion, of course, then I will take the responsibility, and that's when you have this bodhicitta. So that's how to develop bodhicitta. So now we are talking about, so bodhicitta, it is very good to generate bodhicitta, but if you just having a very, what do you call, positive attitude, just wishing to liberate others, that in itself it is good. But if you just leave at that, then it's just a wishful thinking. You wish to liberate all sentient beings, but you are not doing anything about it. You are not really putting effort. So this is about what to do after one has generated bodhicitta. So of course these practices are mainly for bodhisattvas, those who have already developed bodhicitta. So these are the practices what bodhisattvas should do once they have developed bodhicitta. So first, in Lamrim, that there are different topics. So as an introduction to the six perfections, so Lama Tsongkhapa explains why we must learn the trainings after we develop bodhicitta. So as I mentioned, in bodhicitta, there are two types of bodhicitta. One is what is called the aspiration bodhicitta. So that is mainly just wishing, this wishing to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. And then there is another bodhicitta, that is what is called active bodhicitta or engaging bodhicitta, where you really, now you take the bodhisattva's vow and you really engage in practices. So that's what we are going to discuss in this class. So one of the reasons why we need to engage in practices is that you have this big vow to liberate all sentient beings. You say, I want to achieve enlightenment because I want to liberate all the mother sentient beings. I want to bring them to Buddhahood. So that is your promise or your vow. But as we discussed before, in Buddhism, there is no such thing as, there is no such thing as, you just transfer your own realization. There is no such thing as you touch the person and then you cleanse away all the negativities and then suddenly that person becomes Buddha. There is no such way. The person has to practice. And in order to practice, The person needs to rely on a teacher, somebody who can show the path. So this is, I have the picture here. So there's this car on the road. It is like if you are going to take a journey to some place, you need to know the road. You need to, of course, nowadays you have Google Map, then what was that, Waze and all this. You just key in and that's it. But olden times, even in many countries, you don't have that. If you rely on Google, you will end up at another destination completely, you know, opposite of what you are you want to reach. So anyway, so in order to get to a place, you need to know how to get there. You need to know each and every road, the stops and all that. So if you are trying to lead somebody to a particular destination, so you need to first know the road yourself. Otherwise, there is no way that you can lead that person to that specific destination. So for that reason, Bodhisattvas need to engage in practices, all kinds of practices, so that you can master every aspect of every method, because the sentient beings are infinite. It's countless, and countless. And then, yeah, the mental dispositions are all different. Some like momo, some like tukpa, some like sandwiches, some like pizzas. All have different inclinations. So some may not be inclined to develop bodhicitta. Maybe they are more interested in Theravada paths. And if you don't know that, you cannot say that, oh, I only teach bodhicitta. I don't know all this. You cannot say that. You need to be skillful. First, you show them that part, and then slowly, slowly you can lead. Even helping them to achieve a good rebirth, that is also one skillful way. First, you help them ensuring them to find a good rebirth, and then slowly you can lead. So, since there are numerous mental dispositions of the sentient beings, so you need to be able to fulfill all that. You need to be able to cater to each and every being's mental dispositions. So for that reason, you need to engage in practices. And then another reason is that, so in Lamrim, so there are two main points. So one is that demonstrating that one will not become the Buddha by learning either method or wisdom separately. So this is a very important point. And if you read the actual Lamrim Chemo, it is so detailed on this point, because this misconception is so strong and so pervasive, especially during the during and before Kamalashila's time. I don't know which century that is. So there was this Chinese preacher, Hashang. So their view is that all conceptual thoughts are an obstacle to enlightenment. You should not think, you should not do anything. Just blank your mind, and that will get to enlightenment. So there are so many followers because it is so easy to do. And we like that, you see. You say, oh, you don't have to put effort. You don't have to do anything. You just blank your mind. So when you blank your mind, of course, you are kind of avoiding all that unpleasant emotions and feelings. And there is kind of a relaxation. So people like that. And that kind of help to prevail this misconception. So that's why Lama Tsongkhapa really stressed on this point that, you know, in order to achieve enlightenment, we need to have both method and wisdom. There is no way that, you know, just emptiness, just doing a meditation on emptiness will lead to enlightenment, like those Theravada practitioners, those arhats, they have direct insight into emptiness, but they are not Buddha. They only achieved what is called personal liberation, or what we call nirvana, but not enlightenment. So it is obvious that just emphasizing, just engaging in meditation on emptiness is not going to bring oneself, or even, let's put it in a broader sense, just emphasizing on wisdom will not get there. You need all the rest of this. So in terms of perfection, you need the other five perfections. So likewise, just the first, just the method part will also not, alone will not get us to enlightenment, because in order to get there, we need to sever the root of samsara, and there are two, what do you call, the obstacles. Obstacles to enlightenment, obstacles to liberation. We need to sever that from the root. But that one, Bodhicitta is not going to do that. That one you have to rely on the insight, of insight realizing emptiness, the wisdom realizing emptiness. So in that sense, you can see that we need both. So that's why I have an image of bird. In order to fly, you need both wings. Just having one wing, you cannot fly. Same goes with clapping your hands, isn't it? You need both hands. So this is from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. It says that the blind led by the blind do not know the path or have a vehicle, even if they want to go to a special place. They have no way to enter the desired city. If you lack wisdom, you cannot see, and without the other perfections, you have no vehicle and leader. So how can you reach Buddhahood? So the analogy is the blind and maybe, I don't know, shall we use a crippled or amputated person who has no legs? So there was a Hindi movie, I think, old movie called Dosti. Do you know this? It's the story about a blind person and amputated. Do you call that amputated? Amputated, yeah, but who has no legs. So they were good friends, and so they rely on each other. The blind can carry that person without a leg, but the one who is without a leg can serve, can be his eyes. So that's how they are able to get to various places. So this is what it's saying. You need both. The wisdom is like the eye sight. You need the sight. And then the rest of the practices, the method aspect of the practices, are the locomotive to get you there, the other part. Hmm. And the main reason is that in the, I think it's in Panchaparamita, no, it's Pramana, in the Pramana text, Tabjung Teju Koyoba Tejapaya Kawains. So in order to, so as we mentioned that we need to show the path, we need to teach to other sentient beings if we really want to help. But if you yourself don't know the path, if you don't know the subject, then you cannot teach. What I'm teaching here today, if I don't know the subject and if I ask to talk about it, there's no way I can talk. If I'm asked to talk about something, anthropology, something, some topics, I know nothing about that. So that is one reason that you need to know before you teach, before you show sentient beings. And then another reason is that enlightenment or Buddhahood is something that requires all kinds of causes and conditions. even ordinary, our ordinary things like, I don't know, the flour or potato or whatever it is, you need, first of all, you need the seed, and then you need all that condition. And then, like Buddha's the body, I think we have discussed briefly about Buddha's, the qualities of Buddha's body, qualities of Buddha's speech, qualities of Buddha's mind. So all in terms of number, it is like so many qualities. So you cannot expect something to arise from just one cause. There is no way that just one cause can produce all kind of these multiple various results. So for that reason also, you need to engage both in method aspects of practices as well as the wisdom aspects of practice. So that now that leads to the question. So what should Bodhisattva practice? There are so many practices. Where should we begin with? If you just put it in an abstract term, there's a lot of practices. What should we do? But Buddha has put in a very in an easy way, so that you know it is easy to follow. So that's when the sixth foundation comes in. Actually, there is this last one, great compassion, bodhicitta, and perfect method. So Buddha talked about achieving enlightenment and all that. So when he summarized the methods to achieve enlightenment. So Buddha summarized this in three things, like great compassion, bodhicitta, and the perfect method. So here, perfect method refers to the six perfections. So what are the six perfections? Generosity, that is giving others whatever will help them, whether it is one's wealth or even one's own body. And then we have ethical discipline. So this is completely avoiding harming others directly or indirectly. And then we have patience, perfection of patience. That is the ability to bear others' negative actions, which helps us to maintain a virtuous mind and pure conduct. And then we have perseverance. In order to be successful with the first three practices, we need to find joy in whatever we are doing. So that's the perseverance, a special joy when one practices virtues. So this has to come from seeing the value and virtue of whatever we are practicing. And then we have meditation stability. It is the ability to concentrate on whatever one wishes with complete control for as long as one desires. So we will talk this in detail. I'm just briefly introducing this. And then wisdom. So understanding the nature of reality. Of course, wisdom can be understood in many ways. Just knowing from what is right or wrong, it is also a wisdom. But here, what we are talking about is really understanding the nature of reality, which is the emptiness of self and emptiness of phenomena. So now, Lama Tsongkhapa goes on to explain, why must there be a six? Why is this fixed number? Why a fixed number of perfections? Why isn't there seven? Why don't we have 10? Why don't we have less than that? So Lama Tsongkhapa provides actually so many reasons, so many points, but I'm not going to go into all that. I will just focus on maybe one or two. So here, the first is called the fixed number of perfections based on high rebirth. So enlightenment is not something that we can achieve instantly. Enlightenment is not something that we can achieve in this very lifetime. But of course, we have stories and we have people achieving enlightenment in this very lifetime. But it is because that the person has already progressed in the prior lives. So it is not something that you can achieve in one lifetime. You have to progress in the other lifetime as well. So if that is the case, then if we don't ensure we have a what is called the optimum human rebirth, where it enables us, where it facilitates our Dharma practice, then yeah, our practice will not progress. This life, yes, we have this human rebirth, and we have all the opportunities and facilities to practice. But if we don't practice, then next life, if we are born in the lower realms, we are doomed. We will be stuck there for eons, for many years, and our progress has been thwarted. So there is no progress then. So that is why, to ensure that we have repeated higher rebirths, it is saying that we need to practice the six perfections. So basically say that six of these, it is sufficient to ensure you have good rebirths so that you can progress on your path. So first, you need to have wealth. If you are sticking with poverty, there is no way you can practice. You have to look for your basic needs. There is no time. But we need to have enough resources to support our practice. And not only that, even if you have wealth, but if you are not healthy, if you don't have a healthy body, then you will be sick all the time and there is no time to practice. So that is not really conducive to your practice. So we need to have a healthy body. And then even if you have both of these two, but if you don't have a surrounding, a supportive environment or supportive environment or supportive surrounding, let's say your husband and wife, if the wife is really into Dharma practice and if the husband is against that, imagine, all the time they will be fighting. Why are you going there? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Whereas if your husband, even though the person or that person is not into these Dharma practices, but that person is supportive of you, it is great. You can do a lot of things. There will be less of a quarrel. So it is very important, and especially if you are surrounding, let's say in a country where you want to practice Buddhism, but if you are born in a country which is dominated by another religion and which they, you know, discourage Buddhism, it is very difficult to practice. There are places where, you know, it is so hard even to get a permission to invite monks and lamas to come and teach. It is even harder to get permission to build a temple. So imagine, you need to have a supporting environment. And then you need to be able to, you need to have this ability to succeed, to accomplish. Otherwise, yeah, you will never get anywhere. And then even with all this, but if you are prone to, you know, and prone to negative influence, the afflictions, then all that quality will be wasted. So you will be, instead of utilizing that towards achieving spiritual achievement or attainment, you will be using that for the worldly purposes. So that won't serve. So you need to have the ability to kind of stand against the power of mental afflictions. And then you need to have this wisdom to understand your qualities, why you have these qualities. So when you, with the wisdom, you will realize that this is the result of my past actions. With that understanding, with that insight, one is more likely to continue engaging in virtuous action so that this kind of qualities will continue. So that's why we need to have the six. So in order to have wealth, the practice of generosity kind of ensures good wealth. And then ethical practice or ethical discipline ensures healthy body. Remember when we talk about killing, one of the consequences is that if you engage in killing all the time, even if you are not born in lower realms, even if you achieve human rebirth, you will be constantly sick. So that is why he's saying. So with ethical discipline, you will be able to achieve a healthy body. And then with patience, you will have companion and support, a supportive environment. That one we can tell from our own experience. If you are a very patient person, you will have more friends, people to support you. Whereas if you are a, you know, angry person, nobody wants to support you. Nobody wants to even to be near you. And then, of course, if you practice perseverance, then yeah, there is this resultant. Remember, we talk about the result similar to the action. You will have more kind of degree of perseverance. And then with the mental stability, you will be able to be mindful of your physical, verbal, and mental actions so that you will not be influenced or you will be not go under the influence of afflictive emotions. And then, of course, with the wisdom, then you will have proper understanding. So these are the one reason why these six are enough, six are sufficient. And then there is another way of categorizing to fulfill one's own goal and others' goal. So in order to achieve one's own goal, we need to have this insight into emptiness. That is the wisdom part. But the degree of your insight into wisdom is contingent or dependent on the degree of your mental stability. It's not mentally, a meditation stability. When you have this degree of, certain degree of concentration, then your insight or your understanding of wisdom will improve. So these two are for your own goal, to achieve your own goal, in order to achieve liberation for yourself, in order to achieve Buddhahood, you need these. These are indispensable. And then to serve others, you need to have all the rest: generosity, ethical, patience, perseverance. First, you have to help others, but then you need to have this ethical discipline. Restraining oneself from harming others. So if you don't have the ethical discipline, then here you are helping, and then you are doing some harm. So we have to avoid harming others. So no point. We have a saying in Tibetan, "Kangji laksup." That means you wipe your footprint. You do something good, but you wipe it off with the other if you don't have the ethical discipline. And then when you help other people. So sometimes, you know, the response is completely unexpected. You expect the person to show appreciation and all that, but the person started to blame you, started to accuse you. Those times, if you don't have the patience, if you don't have the ability to bear these challenges, then yeah, you won't be able to progress. So that's why we need patience in order to help others. And then if you don't see perseverance, if you don't see joy in whatever you are doing, then you will be able to do one time, second time, third time. After that, no, I don't want to do it. You know, there's no fun. I don't want this. No, it's not worth. You will say that. But when you see value and when you see joy in whatever you are doing, so that is the function of perseverance. When you have that, then you will continue. You will persist on helping others. So that is another way of categorizing. So in terms of fulfilling the two goals, the six is sufficient. So now we are going to touch into each of the six perfections. So the first one is generosity. So what can you tell from this image? I thought this is a very strong message. It has a very strong message here. Anybody want to volunteer? In Tibetan, we have a saying, Pemba mene sambas. Even though you may not be able to really provide help, but there is this intention, you see, the wish to really help. Look at this. What can he do in terms of pulling this wheelchair up on there? But you see, he is willing. He really likes to help. So this is all about generosity. If I summarize all that. So in generosity, we have earlier said the generosity is about, remember the first slide, giving others whatever will help them, whether it is one's wealth or even one's body. So that's why we have two aspects, a consciousness that is willing to give and the physical and verbal actions that are motivated by this attitude. So here the main is one's intention, is this motivation to help, this willingness to give. So that's the main. Because when you have this intention, this willingness, this sincere wish to help others, then your physical and verbal action will follow suit. It will come. But if you don't have this mental aspects in the first place, then it is hard to have the physical and verbal actions. So generosity is actually a sincere desire to give whatever is necessary to those in need. So people may have varying degrees of needs, but there is willingness to give whatever people are seeking. So in Bodhisattva's practice is, I think I have it somewhere. Here it says, Tōpa tamje dēje de kēwō kūn la tāng sēm ki chīmbē pāryū chīn sōng de dēdē dēne sēm nī tōs. So not only giving that action, not just giving that material thing or whatever it is, but even the merit you have accumulated from doing that action, you are also giving that away to sentient beings. So, and then of course, if you are able to give your body, that is something, yeah, a different level of practice. So when we say, I have perfected generosity, so in Shantideva's text, it says that the perfection of generosity is complete when one's attitude is perfect. So it is not that, you know, you have to eliminate all the poverties in the world. And there is this logical reasoning. Shantideva says that if that is the case, if the perfecting generosity is about eliminating all the poverties in the world, then we have to say that Buddhas have not perfected the perfection of the generosity, because they are still poor people. Poverty is still in the world. So it is not about eliminating poverty. It is about your mind that to train your mind to be able to really willing to give everything when the time arises. So in the Buddhist, in the important aspect of Buddhist practice of generosity is training the mind, not the physical act of giving. But of course, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't give anything. We should, as much as we can. But it's most of the time trying to work here. So that is, we are working on our attachment and stinginess. The obstacle that really hinders us from giving or practicing generosity is this attachment. We are so attached to our things. This is very obvious. I think I have demonstrated that before. So if you are asked to give an old phone to somebody, you are more willing to give it. Whereas you ask to give your brand new iPhone, then it is very hard. So this shows that it is attachment, because you have stronger attachment towards your new iPhone compared to your old phone. So old phone, yeah, just you keep it anywhere, wherever it is, okay. But the new one, yeah, you really keep it with you, isn't it? Yeah, so it is to work on our attachment, work our this miserliness or this stinginess when we want to give. So of course, one of the practice when you have difficulty giving, it says that you have to contemplate that, you know, we have taken so many lives before, and there were times we have taken birth of our king and billionaires who have, you know, so much money and all this. But look at us, we are still circling. That is because we held on to our wealth. We didn't practice generosity. We didn't do the necessary practices, so that there was no progress. Because of that, there was no progress. So when you think of that, and then it will help you to kind of loosen that grip on your things, loosen your attachment, to loosen this sense of this stinginess. So there are divisions of generosity. So the first one is the gift of Dharma. So when we talk about generosity, normally we understand generosity as, you know, involving material things. We normally understand as giving something material, giving things to other people. But here it says that not just material things. There are three types of generosity. The first one is the gift of Dharma, giving teachings in order to lead others to clear away ignorance and gain the wisdom that leads to emancipation. So it doesn't mean that you have to sit on a throne and then, you know, teach, but just giving a Dharma advice to a friend or anybody, that is also a practice of generosity. But of course, we have to be very skillful. I have met people who really, really want to help other people, and then they really kind of, what is the word? Force, or what is the other word I'm looking for? You can see the person is not really inclined, but you think that this is so good for that person. And then what happens? You push on and push on, and then person gets kind of develops aversion. When person hear about Buddhism, oh, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to hear about it. Then we have to be careful. You are not really helping. You are really chasing the person away. You have to see how the person is. Even Buddha, when he taught, the first teaching is about all about, you know, there is inherent existence. Because Buddha realized that if we start teaching that there is no inherent existence, nobody is going to follow. Nobody is going to benefit. But first, he taught that there is. He taught just based on the people's this assumption that there is inherent existence. And then later he said there is no such things as self-existence. Everything is dependent dependent on something else. So likewise, even though, yeah, this is another form of generosity, giving Dharma to other people, but we have to be conscious of the person's inclination. And then the second type of generosity is the gift of fearlessness. Any action to alleviate others' fear, to giving protection to other people. So even just insects. So Tibetans have this practice. When you walk on the road, and then when they see, especially during the rainy season, you have those worms, earthworms, so it will be there, and then we will always try and put on the side of the road. And then swimming pools, many times I have encountered, when you go to swimming pools, there are a lot of flies, and they are really struggling there, and helping them is also giving them protections. Then whoever asks for help, if you are able to help, that is also a form of this gift of fearlessness. And in many centers, they have this practice of doing animal liberation. So when I first saw that I think it started by EPMT, so it is very popular. Almost every center, it depends on centers. So some centers, yeah, those who have many members, they do on a weekly basis. So what they do is they go to these wet markets where they sell those animals for killing, and then they buy animals from there. And I have been to these places many times. And you have those chickens being slaughtered, you have this, even turtles. Most of the things that people buy over there in Malaysia is the pigeons. We buy pigeons, and then frogs, then those kind of what you call that, the longish fish, eel, is it?
Eel.
And then, yeah, turtle. So we buy those. And I really like that practice, because not only they just buy and release, they bring it to the Gomba, and they do 1 hour chanting and prayer. And they have these, they will, in the center, they will put the Buddha stupa, and Buddha statue, stupa, and all the holy scriptures and all that. And then they will just circumambulate, carrying the animals. So that the idea is that they will kind of get some imprint, first hearing all these prayers. And you will be surprised, people, the animals will be quite noisy. And when the prayer starts, everybody, all the animals will be very quiet. Somehow it calms them down. And then after that, bring it to the place and release. So these are really a good practice of practicing this, the gift of fearlessness. We are really giving them protection. We are giving them their life back. And then the third one, of course, is the material gift. Generosity of giving material things, and generosity that is just mental. So one is actually giving material things. And the other thing is really training our mind to be able to give, really wishing to give. So this one, when you train, and there will time come whereby, yeah, you have this feeling or this confidence that I can give anything. So that, of course, as mentioned earlier, you need to really contemplate and reduce that attachment. Once you have the attachment, then it's okay. Okay, I think we better stop here. It's already 6 past 11. Okay. So Carolyn raised a question, and I think that is good. I have to explain this. Here we say the perfection of generosity is complete when one's attitude is perfect. So what does perfect means? That was the question. So here I think we need to understand that, like, Arhats, those who follow Theravada path, so they have already eliminated the stinginess. They don't have this attachment to their things. But they don't, they haven't really trained their mind to really give things. to sentient beings. So in that sense, their attitude is not perfect. Even though there is no attachment or stinginess to their possessions, but if they are asked to really give everything to sentient beings, they may not be able to do that, especially their body and all that. So when we say perfect is when you have reached this level where you are able to really give anything. So Bodhisattva, of course, we will later cover that. So when Bodhisattva give, so they don't give things as if it belonged to them. They have already dedicated every possession, everything they have to sentient beings. So when they give, when people ask for things and when they give, their attitude is, I am returning your things. When we give, of course, it's like, oh, I'm giving you, it is mine. But they don't have this possessiveness. They are thinking that their attitude is that, I am returning your things. I have already given to this. I've already dedicated all my things to you. So actually this doesn't belong to me. So it is, I'm giving to you, returning to you, that kind of attitude. So through practice, there will come a time where we are able to really give anything away. There is not even a slight hesitation. So that is, I think it means the perfect attitude when you are able to have this. So that's why we're saying the perfecting generosity is perfecting that mental, that mindset. It is not about the external things. Is that better? And then here, I need to stress this. So when we practice generosity, it is not about the value of things that we give. It is about the attitude. The kind of attitude that we give. So even if we just give $1, but if your attitude is really motivated by compassion and love and care and all that, then that is a practice of generosity, Bodhisattva's way of practicing generosity. Whereas if you give $1 million, but your attitude or your motivation is seeking fame, how charitable that person is, how philanthropic that person is, if you are aiming for that kind of, you know, fame and name, and if you give just $1 million to every being, that is not a Bodhisattva's practice. Of course, that is a practice of generosity, that is act of giving, but that does not constitute as a practice or Bodhisattva's practice of generosity. So now comes the question, so how to give away material things? So first, the recipients of giving, who should we give to? Who are the recipients? So here it says, when we give things, normally when we give things, we have different categories. Oh, this is my brother, I'm giving this. Oh, this is my mother, this is my parent, I'm giving this. Or this is my friend, I'm giving this. Or this is a beggar, I'm giving this. So we give with this kind of discrimination. But Bodhisattva's practice of giving is without any discrimination. Non-discriminatory attitudes towards all sentient beings, and then give equally. Because you are my mother, oh, I'm giving you more. Because you are just a friend, I'm giving you this. Or you are nobody, you know, but since you beg, you are asking for it, I'll give this. So there is no inequality. Whoever asks, you just give. So that's the recipients of giving. So the recipient is actually all sentient beings. No discrimination. Then the motivation of giving, which is with bodhicitta attitudes. So many times we engage in giving, but there is always something there, isn't it? There is always condition, always expectation. It is more of a, what you call, transaction. I give you this, I expect you to return. I expect you to give this and do that for me. So that is our normal practice. Even a beggar comes, we give this and we expect their appreciation, their smile. We expect them to say thank you and all that. But if we don't get that response, we regret. Oh, I shouldn't have given them. Oh, such a ungrateful beggar or person. We say that. So here, when it comes to Bodhisattva's practice, we give with pure motivation or bodhicitta motivation. We don't expect anything in return. You engage in practice with the motivation that I want to help sentient beings. In order to do that, I want to achieve enlightenment. But in order to achieve enlightenment, I need to engage in the cultivation of two merits. Merits, sunam gitso, ishi gitso, the wisdom aspect and method aspect. So for that purpose, I am doing this. I am giving you. That's one way. The other one, this is the bodhicitta's attitude. Other one is really propelled or motivated by compassion and love. That's what we should. If you are really triggered by compassion and love, you will not have expectation. Rarely you expect anything in return. So that becomes a pure giving. And then sometimes, of course, the big companies, they give to charities just to save tax exemption. So that's why the non-profit organizations, they really highlight that. What was that one there? Tax exempted or something, because you want people to donate to you. So those, yeah, even if they give $1 million, if the attitude of the intention is to really, you know, save some tax, then it is not a pure Bodhisattva's practice of generosity. So how to give? Did I cover that? So the motivation of giving, so of course mainly motivated by bodhicitta, and then also as I mentioned earlier, when bodhisattvas give, so they don't have this notion that it is mine. They always have this, I am just, it is yours and I am giving. So that's why there are practices where, I think one of the mandala offerings, so we actually offer everything to our Lama and three jewels. So when you use your things, so actually it looks like you are required to ask the permission, because you have already offered. It is theirs now. It's no longer yours. Yeah, so bodhisattvas, they do that. They just everything dedicated to sentient beings. So when they give, they don't have this. So this is good, because if you have this kind of attitude, then it is less likely to have this kind of a condescending attitude. Like, I am the giver, you are the, you know, the beggar, you know, you are the one who is asking for. And then also we don't have this demeaning kind of behavior. We look down on people. And then, you know, also then you don't have this pride and conceit. Yeah, all this helps. So now how to give? Is there anything here? Okay, there's nothing there. So how to give? So there are certain ways that we should not do. First, if you have decided to give somebody, so if you want to give, just give. You know, don't kind of drag that thing, you know. Oh, come tomorrow, or come tomorrow. That is very common in India. So I have dealings with Indian workers. So one of them told me that Tibetans are the best payers, they say. So when you finish the job, they will pay. Whereas as I working for other, he says, the Indians, I mean, this is his story. He was telling me that you go, you finish all the work there, and then when you go there, you say, oh, no, I didn't have time to go to the bank, come tomorrow. And you go there, and also, oh, today there's another excuse. He says that. Whereas Tibetans, he says that. Tibetans actually, the problem is they pay in advance too much, and then you will, the people will not show up. That's the problem. But once finished, just give. So he told me, I think that holds true for Tibetans. Yeah, once they have completed the job, why are you keeping their money? So this is just an example. So when you give somebody, so you say, oh, you promise somebody, oh, I have these things, I'll give you. And then the person goes, oh, come tomorrow, today I'm not free. So he says that just give. You know, if you want to give, just give. Don't kind of stretch that or drag it along. And then another way we shouldn't do is, and they're asking the person to do things which are unethical or even illegal. You know, asking the person to do this and this thing. You know the example, the best example. Cohen, remember he was saying that I was instructed by the individual number one? Yeah, so this kind of thing. So you give money, but you ask in return to do something that even, you know, that what you're asking the person to do is something that is unethical. So these, yeah, we shouldn't give. And then sometimes, yeah, you promise to give like $100, and then when the person actually comes, you reduce that. You give, you know, only $50. So that's also, yeah, not the way to do. And then, which is very common, so you kind of counting the good things that you have done for the person. Oh, I have done this before, you know, I once know you are, I helped you in this. You are just, I don't know what is the word for that. What is the English word?
Keeping score? Keeping tabs?
Yeah, you say, basically, yeah, Tibetan, we have something, yushewa, kalagir, pugetol, injitol. Yeah, you are saying that, you know, I've done this before, I have, basically, you are boasting your good deeds and then giving it. So this we should not do. So how should we give is with smile, with joy, with happiness, and then with respect. And then it says that you should do it with your own hands. So that's why normally the practice when people make offerings to monasteries, so it normally involves making money offering to individual monks. So it is always advised that you do it yourself. Of course, you can ask somebody to do, but it is always advised that you do it yourself. So here it says that you should do it yourself, not asking somebody, okay, or give 10,000 to that person. So you go and do, and with respect and with much joy and smile. So normally, yeah, this is a good reminder. I also have to remember this. So especially in India when you go, there are so many beggars come there. Sometimes they are so irritating. You give amount, you think that it is quite, and then they will say, what is this? There's no appreciation. You give 10 rupees, they say, what is this, you know? What can I buy with this? That's where you want to take it back. That's not the right thing. You just give and then it's okay. And you should not regret. Sometimes there are, you know, You give, let's say, the homeless people on the street. You give something, and then you turn back, and that person is smoking or something. Then you say, oh, I shouldn't. He is going to use that for his drugs or whatever it is. So when you regret whatever you are given is, what is that word?
Wasted.
Yeah, wasted, or you wiped it off. Wiped off clean.
Diminished.
No longer a virtue. So there is a story relating to that. The story about Aryadeva. You know, yeah, Aryadeva. Aryadeva is blind. When he lost his one eyesight, it is because that when he was sent to debate with the non-Buddhists, so his teacher, who is Nagarjuna, prepared Aryadeva for this debate. So Nagarjuna took the stand of a non-Buddhist and then asked Aryadeva to debate. And so they were debating, and there was a time where Aryadeva felt that Nagarjuna is really non-Buddhist. So what he did was he kind of circled his shoes over his teacher, and then the Nagarjuna said, oh, that was inauspicious. You will have an obstacle on your way. Be careful. So what happened was, as he was walking by, and of course, this is said to be a devil in the form of, you know, a beggar. So he's a blind man. Those days, I don't know, it's true. You can ask for their eye, and they will give you, and somehow it works. I don't know. The story goes like this. So this beggar asked for Aryadeva's eyesight. And Aryadeva, being a bodhisattva, no hesitation, just took out the eye and gave it to him. And walked on. Normally, when you give that, it regenerates. So when he walked away, he heard that pounding sound. So when he turned back, that beggar, instead of using the eye here, he's pounding that eye. So he felt, this regret. Oh, I shouldn't have given it. He has wasted this. Because of that, it did not degenerate. It did not generate. So this story is to illustrate that, you know. Whatever you have given, once you give in, it is their business what they do with that money. You have already given. So better not, you know, feel regret about your action. Otherwise, you lose that merit. Yeah, so now the what to give, things to give. So here it is, you know, since now we are practicing all the generosity, we should give anything people ask for. It says that no, you should kind of examine whatever you are giving. Is there a temporary and ultimate benefit to the person? If there is an ultimate benefit, and if there is both ultimate and temporary benefit, then of course you can give that. But if that whatever the person is asking, whatever you're going to give, is causing the person harm, both in temporary and ultimately, then you should not give. Let's say if somebody asks for a gun, can I please have your gun because I want to go and kill somebody? You shouldn't do that. You cannot say, I am practicing bodhisattva's vows, you know, I must give. No, it says that you have to be wise. You have to use your discernment. You have to use your discernment to see whether that is going to benefit the person or that is going to cause more harm. So if you find that whatever you are giving is going to cause more harm, especially in ultimately, then yeah, it said that you should not give. It is excuse, bodhisattva is excuse from, you know, not giving. So let's watch one random act of kindness. This is in Bhutan.
driving towards Punaka. So on the way, I saw this old grandmother freezing cold. It was like about 2 degrees Celsius outside. And she had a shirt which was very huge. She had a wrapper.
Let me stop there. It's very relative, isn't it? It's just, it's so freezing cold. It's 2 degrees Celsius. And here we are like 32 minus 32.
Which is not even covering her legs. She was walking barefooted. And I went to her feet. I can literally feel her feet. It felt like stone. I'm pretty sure she couldn't even feel the pain from walking on stones and broken things, broken materials. She kept on mentioning about being cold, and I think she's about 87. That's what the people told me at the restaurant. And she sits down. She looks so adorable, to be honest. And then he tells me that she hasn't eaten for 4 days. For 4 days. Nobody bothered her to give her the food. People complain that they haven't had food for a whole day, and it's such a big issue. But she, being 87 years old, she hasn't eaten for 4 days. She ate it the way she ate it. She's so hungry, and I don't know how long she's gonna live with that condition. I mean, I know she's old, but she deserves better than that. As a people, as being in one country, as a small country, we need to help each other out. We need to give, we need to share, we need to learn how to share. We have enough. We complain about our electronics, we complain about stuff we don't have, we complain about little things, and there are people who can't even have food for 4 days, like 4 days. Or just was bare open it. Just
so that's one example of kind of act of kindness. So that concludes the first perfection. And we have 15 minutes. I don't know whether we will be able to cover this. So now the perfection of ethical discipline. So in Lamrim, it is explained under 5 subtopics. So first is what ethical discipline is. It defines what we mean by ethical discipline. And then how to begin the cultivation of ethical discipline. And after that, the types of ethical discipline, and then how to practice, and then a summary. So what is ethical discipline? So the gist is that ethical discipline, it is actually avoiding harming others. So putting a restriction so that we will not engage in actions that cause harm to others. So normally Tibetan, we will say that nyeju dom. Dom is like kind of shut or close the doors. So we, with the ethical discipline, when we have ethical discipline, we are shutting the door of the negative activities. So we are not letting all these negativities to come in. So that is the whole purpose of ethical discipline. So that's why we take different vows, so that we will be able to distance ourselves or kind of protect ourselves from all these the negative actions. It looks like I don't have the rest. How come?
Are they somewhere in your room where I can find them for you?
Yeah, I think I left it in the room. But I think you won't be able to find it. It's okay. Let's see whether I can remember anything. If I don't remember, yeah, I will repeat that next time. So this one, so the ethical discipline is to restrain ourselves from engaging in negative activities. So this only comes when we have this understanding of the benefits of avoiding harm to avoiding doing harm to others. So this when arises when we are able to contemplate on the karma and its results. So we have already talked in the past about these 10 non-virtues and its corresponding results or consequences. So when we contemplate on this, then we will see the merit of following a particular ethical discipline. So this is what it is saying. So likewise, ethical, when we say we perfected ethical discipline, does not mean that now there is no longer any harm occurring to sentient beings. That is not the case. It is like as it is with the perfection of generosity, perfection of ethical discipline is also developing or training this mindset not to harm others. So it doesn't mean that, you know, there is nobody, you know, being harmed. So there's the same logic applies with the earlier one, that if that is the case, then the past Buddhas have not perfected. We have to agree, we have to say that Buddhas have not perfected the ethical discipline, because there are still people who are experiencing harm from other sentient beings. So it is all about developing that mindset. So with loving kindness, compassion, truly wanting to avoid harming sentient beings. So that is the essence of our ethical discipline. So ethical discipline is really with pure motivation, with compassion, and you truly stay away from or prevent yourself from harming other sentient beings. So now how to begin the cultivation of ethical discipline. So this is similar to the first one, that the sole purpose of taking bodhisattva vows is that you can liberate sentient beings. You can bring sentient beings to Buddhahood. And also you see that for the sentient beings to achieve enlightenment, only way is actually practicing ethical discipline. But if you... So after seeing that, you know, this is the only way, so you need to kind of teach sentient beings to practice ethical discipline. But if you yourself is not practicing, then it is difficult. It becomes hypocritic? Yeah. So that's why you need to practice ethical discipline. So how to begin cultivation of ethical discipline is by practicing yourself, by maintaining ethical discipline yourself first. And this also makes a perfect sense, because if you maintain ethical discipline, then you will be avoiding all that negative activities that will bring you down to lower realms. And that the avoiding all these negative activities you will be able to ensure a good rebirth. So that will enable you to continue helping sentient beings. So this is summarized in this stanza. Those endeavoring to help all living beings attain complete enlightenment adorned with pure conduct must first practice ethical discipline themselves. Pure ethical discipline produces the power to succeed. So you need to first practice. The way to begin practice is by practicing yourself. And then, yeah, the next stanza says that, you know, if you are not careful with your actions, then, yeah, you there's this danger of being born in lower realms, and then, yeah, you won't be able to help. You won't be able to progress on your own path to achieve enlightenment, own journey to achieve enlightenment. And then if you are not able to achieve enlightenment, there is no way you will be able to help sentient beings from liberating sentient beings from samsara. So the divisions of ethical discipline. So there are three. So the first one is the ethical discipline of restraint. So this is the normally the what is called the vows of individual liberation. So there are various kinds of vows. We have lay vows. We have sangha vows. Like you have three kinds of vows for nuns, and then we have two kinds of vows for monks. So we have bhikshu, bhikshuni. We have then something called gelopma for the nuns. Yeah. And then we have something called ethical discipline of gathering virtue. So this is once you have, practice ethical discipline, then yeah, because in order to achieve enlightenment, you need to engage in virtuous activities, virtuous actions to accumulate merits that will give rise to enlightenment. So here, the ethical discipline of gathering virtue is literally any virtuous action, anything that you practice, any virtuous action. And then finally, we have the ethical discipline of acting for welfare of living beings. So this is basically helping others, doing any kinds of thing, any type of things that benefits other beings. So engaging in actions that benefit sentient beings. So yeah. So it's more or less same. So of course, this ethical discipline of acting in Tibetan is called Simjin Tuenjik Tsudim. The literal translation will be working for others' welfare. You do any help required. People have different needs. So some people needs with basic requirements for survival things. Some people need help in traveling, getting to some various places. Some people need protection for this and that. So people have various needs. So this is about engaging in these, helping these people fulfill their needs. So that is that constitute as the third types of ethical discipline. So then how to practice? So here it says that how to practice is practicing the ethical discipline not separate from the six perfections. So each, even in just the one perfection, all these six perfections are involved in this. So when we do that, that is the way to practice ethical discipline. So for example, if we are to practice generosity of ethical discipline, then not only you abide by these vows, not only you practice ethical discipline for your own purpose, but also to benefit sentient beings. If you do with that, if you practice the ethical discipline with the intention to benefit sentient beings, that becomes the generosity aspects of ethical discipline. And then, so when you practice, when you are doing practices, so there are so many difficulties. You have to make various sacrifices. You have to let go of many things. So in that kind of a situation, so if you are able to tolerate that, if you are able to bear the hardship, that is the form of patience aspect of ethical discipline. And then seeing the joy in practicing virtue. So even though you go through so many hardships, but you see the joy, you see the value in practicing this ethical discipline, then you will have this consistency, you will have this stamina to move on. So that is the perseverant aspect of ethical discipline. And then we have this to be mindful of our own actions. When we practice ethical disciplines, we have to be mindful, otherwise we will let our three doors open and let all that negativities come in. But if we are able to be mindful all the times, then we will be able to kind of keep all these negativities out. So that is the being mindful part of the part of this practice, is the meditative stability of ethical discipline. And then finally, the wisdom. So this one is what is called the three spheres. So when you practice ethical discipline, and then you are yourself as the doer practitioner, and then the object is the other person. So you are refraining harming others. So that is the object. And then the action of restraining yourself. So these three, you see that as empty. You see that as having no inherent existence. So when you are able to remind yourself and think that way, that is the wisdom aspects of ethical discipline. So that's how we should practice. And then, yeah, since we are just to end this. There you go. Ow. You see the various responses. Some people get so worked up. So I thought that I think that these are good. You see, when you think that this, when you go out and all these happenings, incidences, if you think that this is like candid camera, so when you think that there is somebody taking the shot, recording that, you will be very careful. You don't want to appear, you see, that. So I think this is a good thing. So remember that when anything happens, you think, imagine that, oh, they are recording this. And your response will be different. Okay, it's past 5 minutes to 12. 5 past 12.
So let's say the dedication prayers. First the short mandala offering on page 4, and then the concluding prayers. Let's turn this off.
Massage. Mandala Ganaya Dayame Jimbo Je Maje Panama Jeju Je Jeva Nyamba Meva Ya Kone Kondo Pewa Sho Kuze Ravden Je Namga Tinle Shoju Geva Da Losan Tembe Jame Sasum Ye Jove Mese Tato Ne Yoro Je Kurve Shingamzo, Bendam Dewa Malu Jumene, Chere Sewa Tenzin Jansu Yi, Chabe Sipte Badu Tengyuru Je. Chidra Jemba Da Kundo Zambo Deyan Dejen Te, Teda Kunje Jesu Talo Je, Kewa Teda Tamche Rabdo Ngo. Kisun shebe gyawa tamje gi owa gana chotu nga pati Dajin gewe cawa digun gyanga sambo chuji rabdu nguwa gi